Hello and welcome to Uncovered World, the show where we explore issues not usually covered by the Western mainstream media. I'm Rafael Boffman, joined here by Jacob Arbid.
Hello.
And today our episode will be on Southern Africa. Now, just before we get into our interviews this week, it's time for the Thought Bubble, and that I will be now addressing what the major issues are in Southern Africa and how, and what recent developments have been in the region. So Southern Africa has recently experienced several significant political shifts. Most prominently, Robert Mugabe, president of Zimbabwe since 1987, was removed from power in a coup d'etat in November 2017. In neighboring South Africa, president since 2009 Jacob Zuma was replaced by Cyril Ramaphosa after Zuma became increasingly mired in corruption scandals. In Angola, President José Eduardo dos Santos retired in 2017 after 38 years in power. Transitions of power have also taken place in Botswana, whilst there has been turmoil amongst the opposition in Mozambique. All this makes the current political moment potentially marking a turning point in a historically troubled region. Brutal civil wars in Angola and Mozambique, as well as earlier in Zimbabwe, make the problem of reconciliation in the wake of divided anti-colonial movements a characteristic common to much of the region. Indeed, the histories of Southern Africa are unique in African history due to the large amount of settler colonialism, which created unity around the time of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, but which quickly fell away in the 1990s, as seen by the shifting relationship between Mandela and Mugabe, historically two of the most significant leaders in the region's recent history. The great abundance of natural resources in the region also raises questions as to the existence of a resource curse, with the presence of minerals leading to conflict and a lack of political stability. Nevertheless, the presence of minerals leading to conflict and a lack of regime changes over the past year means there is now hope for more rapprochement and regional unity in the face of rising Chinese influence.
And just to start off with, we'll be speaking to Dr. Justin Pierce. Justin Pierce is a temporary lecturer in African politics at the Department of Politics and International Studies here at Cambridge. He's a bifellow of King's College and a research associate at St. John's College. He serves on the editorial board of the Journal of Southern African Studies. Justin is currently conducting research on the roots and character of political legitimacy in contemporary Southern Africa using comparative case study of Angola and Mozambique, but his broader interests focus on the politics and history of Lusophone and Southern Africa. We caught up with him to see whether there was a unique Lusophone perspective on the region or whether it tied into broader dynamics.
So first question that is relevant to how Angola has suffered from decades of civil war, but has been called by some in the region a model of peace and reconciliation in Africa, particularly in terms of socioeconomic development and the cessation of violence, and indeed arguably scores highly when compared to other countries in the region, such as its neighbour to the north in the DRC. However, this has arguably come at the cost of political repression, and Angola has had the advantage of huge oil revenues for building state capacity. In your view, has the process of Angolan reconciliation in the wake of the civil war been durable and beneficial, or has it been unstable and come at too high a price?
I wouldn't say there's been a process of reconciliation in Angola at all. The civil war ended in 2002. Effectively on the back of a military victory by the MPLA government over the UNITA rebels. Part of that peace process was a general amnesty on all war crimes committed in the course of that conflict, which effectively drew a curtain over anything that had happened during the war. UNITA was given no new political concessions because it was in a weak position militarily. It really had to accept a solution on the government's terms. I think the amnesty suited both the government elite and the UNITA elite, who were both of which would have come under scrutiny had there been any process of investigation about the past. As far as everybody else is concerned, I think the solution that's been imposed is one of, let's move on, forget about the past. the decade or so after the end of the war, you saw quite severe violent repression of the opposition. This was partly to do with a discourse from the government side blaming UNITA as being solely responsible for the civil war, then using this as a way of punishing people who were organizing on behalf of UNITA, particularly in rural areas. In other words, the government used its victory in the civil war to consolidate its political hold over the whole of the national territory. And you have to remember that it was only in 2002 that, even though the MPLA had been in charge of government in Angola since 1975, it was only in 2002 that it managed to extend its authority over the whole national territory. That post-war process of extending its authority was a violent one. It wasn't one that was done by consensus at all. I think any more positive developments that there have been in Angola have been in spite of the way the war was concluded, rather than because of it. I think since about 2011, 2012, you've started to see people trying to claim a democratic space in Angola. The elections that have taken place are still of dubious credibility. I think it's going to be a long time before you can talk about full democratic participation in Angola. Progress is being made slowly, but I think that's largely because of pressure from below rather than from anything that's come from above. I think on the question of the Angolan economy, the fact that the government was able to stamp its authority so clearly on Angola in the aftermath of the civil war was to do with the fact that the end of the war in Angola coincided with a global boom in the oil industry. This is to do with China looking for new energy sources at the same time as the United States is trying to find sources of energy outside of the Middle East in the aftermath of the Iraq war. So what you have is, just as Angola's coming out of the war, there's huge foreign interest in Angolan oil as the price of oil goes sky high, which meant it resulted in really crazy unsustainable GDP growth rates for Angola, 30% annual GDP growth in 2007. That obviously couldn't be sustained. It created boom conditions in the Angolan economy, followed by a bust as soon as the oil price collapsed in 2014. But in that decade or so that the government had almost unlimited access to oil money, it was able to use that money to political ends, buying off the opposition, kind of trying to impress the public with spectacular construction of spectacular infrastructure.
Yeah, so you've mentioned kind of the role of the government and hinted at like elections that have gone on there. So you say the last year has arguably been one of regime change in several southern African countries. In Angola, this has taken the form of the resignation of José Eduardo dos Santos in late 2017 and his replacement as president by General João Lourenço. I hope I'm pronouncing that. João Lourenço, okay. He has acted to remove allies of dos Santos at many levels of government, including removing his daughter Isabel, the richest woman in Africa, as head of the state oil monopoly. Given this, how does, in your opinion, does Lourenço intend to rule?
It's very difficult to tell at the moment. I think he, soon after he came to power, he generated enormous goodwill, surprised a lot of people by his readiness to make changes at the top. I mean, in particular, removing Isabel dos Santos from the state oil company Sonangol, also removing her half brother José Filomeno dos Santos, the former president's oldest son, who was head of the Angolan Sovereign Wealth Fund. an asset fund worth about $5 billion in spare oil revenue, which had been become almost indistinguishable from José Filomeno's private business interests. He was another figure who João Lourenço got rid of. Also, various senior figures in state security were cleaned out. So initially, what appeared to to be a decisive break from the past was welcomed by a lot of people in Angola, including some who'd been quite cynical initially towards the change of presidency. How far that's going to go, we don't know. Dos Santos's grip on the state has been broken. The fears that João Lourenço was simply going to be a puppet for José Eduardo dos Santos have been disproven. However, it does seem to be clear that João Lourenço is appointing his own people who aren't entirely clean either. There are still issues around judicial independence in Angola, for example, which have not yet been resolved. So there's a possibility this could simply be cosmetic change rather than anything deeper.
Just one final question, if that's okay. Just to take a more regional perspective, Southern Africa with the oil in Angola, minerals in South Africa, Botswana and Zambia, and the abundance of agricultural land throughout is perhaps a large case study for the perhaps slightly controversial idea of the resource curse. The idea that the presence of large, valuable primary product deposits allows for authoritarian resilience because the government doesn't need to build a tax base. In light of your own research in the region, do you believe that this idea has any truth to it, or is a more nuanced approach needed to understanding authoritarianism in the region?
I mean, I would say resource endowment doesn't necessarily lead to authoritarianism, but it can certainly enable it through that process of allowing states to get away without building a tax base. In this sense, countries like Botswana and South Africa are very different from Angola. South Africa, because you have a far more diversified economy, in which industry and the service sector have overtaken primary extraction. I mean, although South Africa has an important mining sector, you can't call it simply an extractive economy. And yes, this is linked to a more fully realized democracy in South Africa, a more inclusive civil society. A greater degree of civic participation in political life. Botswana, even although on paper it looks like a resource economy, it's heavily dependent on diamonds. There are other reasons why Botswana hasn't ended up as a case of the resource curse, and that's just to do with the particular way in which institutions have evolved historically, whereas somewhere like Angola, it looks like a particularly bad example of the resource curse. But you have to remember that the abundance of riches, or the curse of riches that came with the oil boom, particularly after 2003, that came on the back of a history of a particularly brutal colonial dictatorship, followed by years of authoritarianism and civil war. So that when the MPLA regime in the early 2000s started to take advantage of the oil windfall to consolidate its power by brute force. It could only do so on the back of a particular history.
That was Justin Pearce. Now, to get a more Anglophone perspective on the region, as well as dealing with some of the perhaps more conceptual problems of academic and journalistic study in the region, we spoke to Saul Dubow. Saul is the Smuts Professor of Commonwealth History at Magdalen College, Cambridge, and his teaching and research concentrates on the history of modern South Africa from the early 19th century to the present. He has published widely on the development of racial segregation and apartheid in all its aspects, political, ideological, intellectual, and institutional. Saul grew up in South Africa and studied at the universities of Cape Town and Oxford. He has also taught at the universities of Sussex and Queen Mary. We caught up with him to speak about the legacy of apartheid in South Africa, the anti-colonial struggle across the broader part of Southern Africa, and whether these countries can ever, and indeed may now be, experience a post-colonial, post-apartheid moment. Perhaps the most important event in South Africa, and possibly Southern Africa of the last few months, has been the resignation of Jacob Zuma and his replacement with Cyril Ramaphosa, who's advocated for economic reforms and a strong line on corruption. The pickup in South African growth and investment in recent months suggests that he is increasing business confidence, but do you believe that he will be able to decisively resolve South Africa's endemic corruption problem and anemic economic growth? And what sort of obstacles do you think will lie in his way?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a very big question. I don't think anyone could give a pat or simple answer. There's no doubt that the endemic corruption, certainly in the very senior reaches of South Africa, began even before the Zuma regime. And one of the first things that Zuma was involved in, even before he became president, was the very large arms deal with the French. So Zuma has had so many different accusations against him, and he's played the politics of patronage rather well, rather too well in many ways. And that means that his supporters owe loyal to him, not so much ideologically, but because of the corruption, because of the deals, because of the bodies in the bodies that are buried in the skeletons in the cupboard, That makes it extremely difficult for Ramaphosa to root out the corruption. Ramaphosa has the benefits from being one of South Africa's richest men. He came through. He was a poor man. Came through the trade union struggle. Committed Christian. His money was made in ways that nobody has accused him. Nobody's accused Ramaphosa himself of corruption. But there are very few people who've benefited from black empowerment deals who have not been beneficiaries of either state or corporate patronage. So Ramaphosa's problem, in many ways, is to balance a cabinet which is very much divided between his own reform-minded supporters and the Zuma stalwarts. And it's not at all apparent that he'll be able to win this battle in the short term. But he certainly has to keep the momentum going.
Do you think that the sort of institutional character of the ANC has something to do with this?
Yes, undoubtedly. The ANC still commands about two-thirds of the support in the country, political support in the country, but it's increasingly fragmenting. And for the last 10 or 15 years, the route to advancement in the ANC has relied on the ability to deliver votes and the patronage, the contracts, the tenderpreneurialism, as it used to be called, that follows. But the ANC also looks back to its struggle history when the calls for party discipline, for selflessness, for service to the struggle, for socialism were very prominent. And in many ways, Ramaphosa, who was represented the internal wing of opposition and was not, in fact, fully identified with the ANC, very much part of the trade union movement with a much more strong history of non-racialism and democratic organization at the workplace, all these different traditions are vying within the ANC, for supremacy within the ANC.
I suppose taking a sort of regional comparative perspective, there has been a lot of regime or at least leadership change within Southern Africa over the last year. We've seen the selection of the new Angolan president, Lourenco, the new Swazi king, and of course the sort of silent coup of Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe. Do you believe that there's some sort of pattern here? Do you feel like it could have implications for the region, or is it mostly a series of unconnected events?
That's an interesting question. I would guess in the first instance that these are unconnected, but there is the potential for them to become connected. The Southern African region, through organizations like SADC and so forth, the anti-apartheid movement, very much saw South Africa as a political region. Of course, economically, in many ways, it's a region with South Africa as the dominant core. But that's not to say that the Botswanans, the Zambians, the Zimbabweans, the Angolans, the Mozambicans all have common interests. But it is of singular importance that in Angola, in Mozambique, in Angola, in Zimbabwe, and in South Africa, there have been significant changes of regime at the top. And if those leaders can find each other and form a common agenda, then they may well be able to strengthen each other in their reformist hopes.
Thinking beyond forces, the political forces of the ANC, you've talked about the economic freedom fighters. We've also seen in the 2016 elections a massive sort of surge in support for among others, Musimayane's Democratic Alliance. In some sense, this is perhaps as a result of a generation of post-apartheid South Africans. Do you think we're moving on to a genuinely post-apartheid politics in South Africa?
I think the hopes that South Africa post-apartheid would immediately transform itself into a beacon of non-racialism were always misguided, and to some extent they were misguided because of the hopes that was invested by countries overseas, not least in Britain, who felt somehow that with Mandela the Messiah had arrived and we'd have the city on the hill. It was always, I think, unrealistic to expect that 300 years of segregation, of violence, of slavery would be transformed within a generation. And this is compounded, of course, by the ANC's embrace of a particular kind of capitalism, a kind of corporate capitalism, which resulted in very little transformation in terms of land ownership, resources, wealth. So South Africa is a long way from becoming the kind of post-apartheid society that people in the 1990s and early 2000s had hoped for. It's a very divided society. But on the other hand, I think it would be wrong as well to think that it remains simply an apartheid society. An enormous amount in South Africa has changed and is changing. Maimane's leadership of the DA, the Democratic Alliance, is interesting too, because the DA is the lineal successor of the liberal and very much middle-class progressive party from the 1970s and 80s. And it is still seen by many people as a largely white, largely liberal-minded party. And Maimane has really, in some ways, struggled to change perception, so that although the DA remains the dominant party in the Western Cape and is increasingly making inroads into some of the metropolitan areas like Gauteng, Johannesburg and so forth, there really is a problem in that he is seen by many people as, probably wrongly, as a puppet of white capital, white monopoly capital, as Julius Malema of the EFF constantly reminds us. So this is, I think, also an indication of just how complicated South Africa is as a society. It's a very dynamic society. It is a society where ideas are still freely freely in circulation. It still has quite strong civic institutions. One of the lessons that we learned from the resignation of Zuma was that the judiciary and the constitutional court is still very much intact. So all these things are in play, and I think it's difficult sometimes if you only follow South Africa intermittently in terms of the sort of major crises to get a sense of the continuity and get a sense of how it is struggling, in many ways successfully, but with lots of obstacles to become a truly post-apartheid society.
Do you see this as a sort of symptom of a Western media who only sort of focus on Africa when things go wrong?
I think there's a lot that is a large amount of truth in it. The Western media, for many, many years, have had a rather simplistic view, an increasingly simplistic view of Africa, a place which is racked by tribal conflict, by war, by instability, by corruption. Now, all of that is true, but if attention only switches episodically to countries which are going through particular turmoil, if you don't understand the full context, then you miss out on some of the other important factors. And I think this is particularly the case in South Africa, where for many people in the 1970s, 80s and 90s, when there was massive and consistent press and media interest in South Africa to the anti-apartheid struggle, there was a sense after Mandela's death perhaps that the international media washed their hands and said, right, job done, and then reverted perhaps to a particularly critical reflex, perhaps led by people who felt, oh well, the whole sort of pro-Mandela, pro-non-racialism was always got up by people who were naively optimistic, and now we have the chance to tell some real home truths. And I think that switchback, particularly with the lack of consistent reporting, is in many ways unfortunate.
That was Saul Dubow speaking to Uncovered World. That's all we've got time for this week on our episode on Southern Africa. Thank you very much for tuning in, and we look forward to seeing you next time, where we will be exploring issues in the Caucasus related to Armenia and Turkey. Thank you very much for listening.
Goodbye.